to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today has loved the high deserts all his life and has embraced Native American traditions. When he was an adult, Garth Nielsen was adopted by a woman of the Turtle Clan of the Iroquois. He's been able to talk to many elders over the years and participate in traditional ceremonies. In appreciation to all those who have reached out to him in friendship over the years, Garth Nielsen compiled stories from his own experiences and from tales told to him by the people he met. His first book, Odyssey of a Spiritual Nomad, he described his personal journey of discovery. He now has published a second collection of stories called Petroglyphs. Garth Nielsen, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, when I first saw your cover, the name of your book is Petroglyphs, and I saw the petroglyphs on the cover, and I wasn't sure if somebody had, this was a sketch or a photograph, and then I realized, well, it's a photograph of a sketch, so to speak. Describe the cover of your book for us.
The petroglyphs on the cover of this book are from a Nevada State Park outside of Las Vegas. It's called the Valley of Fire. And this particular area is literally covered with petroglyphs that go back centuries.
So if people would like to see some real petroglyphs, there really is not that far a drive to see them.
No, it's not.
But you didn't. You aren't the one who took this photograph.
No, my friend Kim Victoria, who is the wife of Tom Watson, she is, like myself, is totally enamored of the Southwest. And she has spent a lot of time down in southern Nevada and northeastern Arizona. And she's the one that took these. And she's got an incredible collection of photographs that she's taken from the Valley of Fire.
So she probably didn't have to make a separate trip. She may have already had this in her photographic file.
She and I went through all of her photographs to pick out what we wanted to put on the cover.
Well, you mentioned that she is married to Tom Watson, and you, in your dedication, acknowledge both Kim and her husband, Tom Watson.
Yes.
And how did Tom help?
I owe Tom my literary life, literally. I was, through an acquaintance, I was asked to join a small writing club up in Paradise. And Tom is a member of that club as well. And after about 3 or 4 weeks of, you know, the participants reading the things that they had written, one day Tom said to me, I'd like to speak to you privately. And we went outdoors and he said, look, I really like what you've written. I'd like to get to know you better and I want to sit and talk with you. And so, to use the cliche, the rest is history. We have discussed in great measure a lot of what I've done. And he said, you need to be out there. People need to read what you've written. And this is the result of my acquaintance with Tom Watson.
Well, you might mention that Tom is not just an unpublished writer giving you advice, but he has actually published quite a number of books himself.
Yes.
What is his specialty?
Children's literature, and he's very, very good, and he's very well received, by the way.
Yes, I know Tom.
Oh.
And I also, when I saw in the local paper, the Enterprise Record recently, that Tom is now president of a new writer's club here. And you are also a part of this club.
As of last month, I am a brand new member. I've only been one time.
Well, this is actually new because, as I understand it, the California Writers Club has created this branch called the North State Writers Branch that Tom Watson is the president. And then a couple of other local writers are also a part of this. And I didn't know that the California Writers Club is the second oldest writers organization in the country.
That's right.
I would have thought someplace back east would have been had that honor.
This was started by Jack London. A lot of people don't know that, but that's an interesting thing in itself.
Yes, it is. So you have become a member of a group whose origins go back to Jack London.
Yes.
We might mention that this group meets Mondays, the third Monday of the month, from 6 to 8 p.m., if there are people out there who are aspiring writers.
I would suggest that anybody who feels that they want to try to get whatever they've written out there, this is the place to maybe come and see what you can do.
And appropriately, it meets at the Chico Library.
That's right.
My guest is Garth Nielsen, and his new book is called Petroglyphs, and it is a collection of short stories, thoughts, observations, and impressions about traditional Native Americans that he has known and the landscapes they inhabit. Now, I mentioned the cover of your book, the front cover. The back cover is a photograph of you, and you're not the only one in the picture.
That horse belongs to a good friend of mine who is a world champion barrel racer. That horse cost $20,000.
Oh, my goodness. So are you a horse rider or something?
I was once, but I can't because of my bad leg and back. I can't ride anymore.
But you look very distinguished with your walking cane.
Thank you.
Well, complete the picture for us as to how you dress normally.
That's how I dress normally.
Which is you wear... Well,
very casually. The turquoise necklace was a gift many, many years ago from a dear friend. I do smoke a pipe.
Yes, because in the picture you have a pipe.
Yeah, and what else?
And your hat.
The little button on the hat up there was a nickel that was carved out with just the Indian left on it, and it was gilded, and an acquaintance gave that to me, so I wear that on my hat.
So your necklace has meaning for you, your turquoise necklace that you were wearing in the photograph, and right now.
Yes.
And your hat that is also special. And it looks like cowboy boots.
I was born in boots.
Well, actually, where were you born? Because it sounds like you were born out in the high desert, but you weren't.
No, I was born in Glendale, California, but at the age of six, my parents moved to Reno, and back in those days, Reno was a little cow town, basically, and I lived my whole life up in northern Nevada, Reno, Carson City, that whole area.
Well, there's a little section in your book where you mention you're telling this in the first person, and this is on page 10, Garth, and this section of your book is one that's called The Skull. And the reason I'd like you to read that is because you mention your father in this section. Would you read that for us, please?
Yes, ma'am. My father was born and bred in a large eastern city. For years, all his thoughts were shaped by decisions from a crowded and consensual accordance until he moved to Nevada as a young adult. A change, subtle but unyielding, in its grasp began to occur within him and call into question all of these old thought patterns. He fell under the influence of the spirits of limitless horizons of sagebrush and pinion-dotted hills, mirages that shimmered across the salt pan playas, and vistas where the vestiges of the early settlers and those who had passed through, bound for the glories of California, could still be found. When the turquoise gem of Pyramid Lake first met his astonished gaze, the die was cast. Every opportunity that presented itself was a reason for making the 32-mile drive from Reno, summer or winter. During the summer, nearly every weekend was spent under a lean-to of furniture blankets, while my brother and I swam or skimmed stones as flat as silver dollars across the placid surface of the lake. My father even bought a boat that he sailed across the lake so that he could look more closely at the namesake pyramid. We never went ashore on Anaho Island, a federally protected bird refuge. One incident that stands out vividly in my memory is the day my father found the upper half of a human skull on the beach at Pyramid Lake. The gentle waves washed around it, making the long green moss clinging around it appear as undulating hair. I remember thinking that it could have been the remains of a mermaid. Was it from a drowned swimmer or someone sucked down by quicksand patches found in the northwest end of the lake? We were told that the lake had been used as a bombing range during World War II. Perhaps it was the remains of a lost airman. Or was the skull much older? We never knew. I won't say that this beautiful, mysterious lake took what rightfully belonged there. Rather, I would say that some long-forgotten soul returned to our Creator and became part of the mystique, one with the spirit of place. One has to wonder about such a death. I long ago abandoned the concept that accidents happen. Things happen for a reason. But still, what was the reason for this death? Was this a man or a woman? I believe all life returns to our Creator. So all that we see is the residual of life on earth.
My guest is Garth Nielsen, and he's reading from his new book, Petroglyphs. A couple of things strike me in what you were just saying, Garth, that I think the rest of us might benefit from paying attention to. One, you say that for years, you're talking about your father now, for years all his thoughts were shaped by decisions from a crowded and consensual accordance until he moved to Nevada as a young adult. That consensual accordance.
My father was born in New York City. At the age of six, my grandmother returned her family to Denmark, which is where she was born. And when they came back to the United States about 4 years later, he couldn't even speak English then. He had to learn English all over again. And everything was shaped by the metropolis of New York City. And he was very locked into a cityified way of looking at life. And when he moved to Nevada, it was almost like a screen was pulled down before his eyes. And everything that had been in his past suddenly vanished, and he became literally a new person. The persona of the desert did its job, and it did it well. My father became a bona fide desert rat.
So what he thought was who he was when he was living in the city,
yes,
that's who he thought he was.
That's right.
And then when he came to Nevada, he thought, no, this is who I am.
Exactly. You've got it. That is exactly it.
Well, then a little bit later on in this section, you say, I long ago abandoned the concept that accidents happen. Things happen for a reason.
I truly believe that. I'll be 77 next month. So in 77 years of living this life that has been given to me, I have... as most people would begin, things happen. Well, that's just an accident. But as the years roll by and you begin to take a look at things that have happened in the past, how your life is progressing in the present, and how you hope to see it progress in the future, you begin to realize everything is a chain of events, and that what happened 10 years ago impacts directly on what you're doing, what you're saying, what you're thinking right now. And this is why it happened, so that you could think and do and say what you're doing right now. And there is no such thing as an accident. In northern New Mexico, where a lot of the small villages back up in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, the people speak a Spanish that's not readily understood by people in Arizona or California who speak Spanish. That they speak an archaic Spanish. And they have a word, chiripada. And chiripada basically means serendipitous. And I think that's such a great word. It's not used anymore, but it's a great word.
In fact, I might mention that you do have words in here from Native American language and from Spanish in a glossary,
yes,
in the back. So if people are reading along and they wonder, for example, what a buaro arro is, for example, that was a buzzard, which you tell, yeah, us you can look back. Because in, yeah, the story itself, you don't say what that is, but people can refer to the glossary and say,
right,
oh, that's a buzzard.
Right.
The story that you were just telling, and then you say that things... don't happen by accident. They happen for a reason.
They happen for a definite reason.
And it seems, too, that you are open to guidance. From what source do you think your guidance comes, Garth?
My guidance, I truly believe, comes from one source, but it's spread out, if you will. Ultimately, it comes from God Almighty, if you will. But who works through the spirits of the land and the spirits of those who have gone before, who impact on my thinking. You can't walk in a place like the Valley of Fire, where the panels of petroglyphs that are thousands of years old, without knowing, not just thinking it might be the case, but actually knowing that the person who did that is still there.
Well, you also, at one point in the story you're telling, say, it felt good to be here. And I think a lot of people have had that experience, Garth, of being in a place where they just feel so at home and so comfortable. And that sounds like what the desert is for you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It truly is.
If we were to put you back in New York City where your father was, for example.
I would die within a week. I got to believe. I truly do. I think I'd die within a week.
Well, just before this story that you just read, which you're speaking in the first person, that really, you say, happened, and I can just imagine coming across, you know, you're out with your dad, and you see half a human skull on the beach, that you wonder, my goodness, how could this, what is the story behind this skull?
I've wondered that my whole life, exactly. That's what I've tried to describe in the small piece that I wrote there.
Mm-hmm. Well, just before this, you have this just a little paragraph, the voices of the people. And you say, when I hear the speech of the people, I understand not one word, but the passion in their hearts speaks to mine. The passion in their hearts speaks to mine. It is the music of their speech, not one word of which I understand, that sings in my heart.
That's right. That piece right there basically came from a number of years of attending the Sundance down in southern Arizona at a place called Big Mountain. And it was primarily on what in those days was known as the joint use area, but the Navajo people have such a musical speech, and it's so melodic. And to hear an elder will say, an elder woman, 70, 80, 90 years old, they don't stutter, they don't hesitate, but it's a flowing, like a stream. Their language flows like a stream, and it puts goosebumps on your arm.
Well, I sometimes, when I hear a poem in a language that I may not even understand, but the poetry, like you say, the musicality of it,
yeah.
I understand it. It touches me.
Absolutely, yes, yes. And this is what makes people want to get to know these people.
Well, speaking of getting to know them, you tell us as readers what the Native American experience is like, if I may sum it up that way, in the very first story in your book. And some of these things you are telling in the first person because they were your experiences.
Yes, ma'am.
But this story, the first story in your book, is entitled Amos Chalk. Who was or is Amos Chalk?
Amos Chalk is a metaphor. He is a metaphor for those Native people who are attempting to maintain as strongly as possible the traditions, the way of life, the language that has been handed down to them through the centuries, and that in many cases, they're being forced to assimilate against their will into the dominant society, which is what I'm trying to explain there. And that when the airplane crashes, I'm trying to show that this technology really has no place in the life of a person who is following the traditional road of their people.
Well, let's tell the listeners what happens to Amos Chalk.
Okay.
Amos Chalk is in an airplane, and you mentioned there's a doctor in the plane, and then you say the man from the bureau, and you don't say what bureau. It's not the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It's not the Federal Bureau of Land Management. It is, and we have to assume, Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Assume correctly.
So go ahead and tell what happens in the story so we'll understand what you're...
Amos Chalk is being raised by his sister and her husband, and they want him to go to the Indian school at Stewart, which, by the way, no longer exists as an Indian school. It was closed down many years ago, and he doesn't want to go. And so they make arrangements, and he goes with the doctor and the Bureau of Indian Affairs man, and they fly to Carson City. He goes to Stewart. He sees it. He doesn't want to be there, and they're flying home, and the airplane crashes in the mountains. And the doctor and the man from the Bureau are killed, and Amos is left to his own devices. And I'm trying to say here that he sees that this airplane took him out. And I'm trying to show the analogy that modern technology has no place for people with who are basically following the traditional way of life. And so he takes off to try to find out where he's at and hopefully get home. And things happen to him as he's walking across the desert. He sees mirages. And he sees the skeleton of a coyote in the playa and that he's walking across. And as he's walking, the spirits of the land and the spirits of his ancestors are all about him. And they are there to support him. And as he's thinking, as he's walking, of an elder who is sitting on the bench of the store at the little town of Owyhee up on the Duck Valley Reservation, Mrs. Charlie. And Mrs. Charlie represents everything that's good and pure and wonderful about the traditional way of life of the people, and he wants to reach out to her. And he says he wants to help her, but in reality, he's asking her for her help to him.
So in the story, he's going to help her, and he realizes that she is helping him.
That's right. I hope that was clear.
Yeah, well, you also, he there is left to his own devices.
Yes.
Because the two people he was with are dead. And there's a place in your book where you say of yourself, this is, you're speaking in the first person, I am never alone. Those who've been considered dead by the dominant society are yet among us. And later on, you say that you feel like the mountains, the valleys, the sagebrush, the pinyons are all your relatives.
That's right. This is why the Lakota phrase that I use in ceremony, which was taught to me many years ago, Metakuye Oyosan, all my relations, because we as the two-leggeds, we are related to everything on this planet. I'm related to you as I speak to you. I'm related to those trees out there, the birds, what they call the winged ones, the green and growing nations, the four-leggeds, those that creep and crawl, those that swim. All of these things are placed there for our sustenance, and we in turn have to respect them because of what they do for us when they become our relations.
Well, when you say, and I think people will say, well, that was nice of him to say this. You say, I'm never alone. Those who have been considered dead by the dominant society are yet among us.
They surely are.
And they probably think, well, Garth, that's nice. They're in your heart.
No. They may be in my heart, to be sure, but they are also around us, and they guide us. Whether we acknowledge that guidance is beside the point. They are guiding us if we would but respond to them and put our hand out to reach and say, give me a hand. There's something I can't do without your help.
So to have an openness to maybe there is guidance there.
Yes.
Maybe my grandmother is looking after me and wishing me well, and maybe I can benefit from following her guidance.
That's right. That's right.
My guest is Garth Nielsen. He's written a couple of books, at least. One is The Odyssey of a Spiritual Nomad, his previous book. And his newest book is Petroglyphs. And I assume that you still have more stories to tell.
Book three is due to be out before this year is over.
Well, there's a lot of things in here that I think it's food for thought for us to consider what we can learn from Native Americans, because now this is my own view of things. When the Europeans arrived, we thought we were the superior culture and these poor primitives had nothing to teach us. And I think we Europeans are learning, maybe there is something we can learn from Native Americans. You say perhaps they, referring to their white friends, perhaps they were here once before, long ago.
That's right.
So perhaps those who, like you, as a white person, who are so open to these traditions and ceremonies of the Native Americans, maybe you were here once before, long ago.
I can't say yes on that. I can't say no on that. But I was told by that same individual who has now passed on
So this was a real elder, spiritual
yes,
elder that
ma'am.
You're quoting.
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am. He was a Yowemi. Okay, the Dhammist Society called them Yakis. That's not their name for themselves. Their name for themselves is Yowemi. It means the people. And he was a very, very good friend of mine. And I learned a great deal from that man, Anselmo Valencia. He was the spiritual leader, the political leader, the economic leader of all of the Yowemi barrios and neighborhoods in southern Arizona. And he was an incredible human being.
So this, when you're quoting him, you're quoting a real person.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, you, as much as you love the high desert, you don't live in the high desert. You live in paradise.
I am required to at this point in time because of the fact my mother is in a nursing home. She is 101 years old. And to do the right thing, I have to be here for my mother.
But this also is an opportunity then for you to write your stories and pass along what you have learned
That's
from
right.
these people whose wisdom you value.
I never would have met my friend Tom Watson if I'd been still down in Arizona.
And you might not have actually gotten these stories
that's
in print.
That's right. My wife says, I don't want to hear it. You're here for a purpose.
Well, mentioning your wife, she is also acknowledged in your dedication.
She's my editor.
And she is a partner in encouraging and supporting storytelling.
I couldn't have done it without her.
Now, is she as fond of the high desert as you
oh,
are?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Petroglyphs is your newest book, and you have on the cover photographs of petroglyphs. And your book contains short stories, your own thoughts and observations and impressions about traditional Native Americans that you have known and the landscapes where they have lived.
Yes, ma'am.
The situation with Native Americans is in the news now, and I don't know if people realize that there are 56 million acres of land that belong to tribes and individual Indians, but they are held in trust
That's right.
by the Interior Department's Bureau of Indian
BIA,
Affairs.
Right.
And this policy was intended to protect Indians from trespass and encroachment by the states and non-Indian settlers. But it has become a way to control what the tribe can do with its own land. And I was surprised to know that the federal government actually owns title to Indian lands.
I'm not going to mention any names because it's a political issue and I don't want to cause you or anybody
sure.
else any problems.
Sure.
But there is a situation going on right now with on the Apache Reservation down in Arizona, up at White River, or up on the San Carlos Reservation, where permission has been given to do mining on the reservation and they don't want it.
Well, we'll follow this in the news, and meanwhile, we'll read the wisdom of the Native Americans from your book, Garth.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
My guest has been Garth Nielsen, and his new book is Petroglyphs. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.